There's been such a groundswell during COVID and after COVID in general, but particularly in the law space. We're such lead adopters of so many things usually in law. And so I thought, oh my gosh, when there are like more law podcasts, like it's still just the tip of the iceberg of what could be done with it.
Welcome to Warfare of Art and Law, the podcast that focuses on how justice does or doesn't play out when art and law overlap. Hi, everyone. It's Stephanie. And that was M.C. Sangaila, appellate attorney, author, as well as creator and host of the Portia Project podcast, through which she highlights women in the law in order to inspire future generations. During our conversation, Ms. Sangaila shares about the vast range of her appellate practice, from U.S. and international human rights to Nazi-looted art cases. We discuss the many procedural impediments faced by heirs seeking restitution of property taken during the Holocaust through outright theft or forced sale, as was the case in Zuckerman versus the Metropolitan Museum of Art, which dealt with an heir's claim for return of Picasso's masterwork, The Actor. Ms. Sangaila worked on the Zuckerman petition for certiorari before the U.S. Supreme Court, raising queries about the meaning and application of the Holocaust Expropriated Art Recovery Act, known as the HEAR Act, that was passed to enable claimants to bring time-barred cases for a limited time and provides that defenses at law should not be a hindrance, thus allowing courts like the Second Circuit in Zuckerman to find defenses at equity, like latches, can prevail over an heir's claim in certain instances. Ms. Sangaila also shares about her work in the long-running Kasser case brought by heirs seeking restitution of a masterwork by Impressionist Camille Pissarro, her thoughts on the policy issues surrounding suits against foreign sovereigns in the U.S., like Kasser, as well as the Guelph Treasure case, and how the copyright issues at play in the appeal brought by the Andy Warhol Foundation, currently pending before the U.S. Supreme Court, highlights the need to balance protection for original creators and subsequent creators who might build on those original works. We then shift to how Ms. Sangaila defines justice and how her book publishing enabled her to follow her intuition to create the Portia Project podcast, and how both these pursuits are meant to inspire and empower women to follow their unique paths.
M.C. Sangaila, welcome to Warfare of Art and Law. Thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Thank you, Stephanie. I really appreciate being here. And I really enjoy your podcast and what you're doing. And I always enjoy meeting a fellow legal podcaster. So thank you.
Would you begin with giving an overview of the range of your work?
Oh, sure. So I am an appellate lawyer. So I don't do trials. I persuade and convince judges on appeal from trials. And I've done work in the U.S., in state Supreme Courts, in the U.S. Supreme Court, and also internationally in some human rights commissions and courts. So a range of locations. And then also in terms of a lot of my work has been significant amount of pro bono work in, I would say, areas in impacting women and girls, both domestically and internationally, Holocaust art recovery in the U.S. So I haven't done anything outside the U.S. in that regard. And I also have done a fair amount of immigration work in U.S. courts involving asylum, political asylum, persecution of women and girls, just a range of areas.
Could you give some examples of the human rights cases you've worked on where the result particularly resonated with you?
Yeah, so I mean, there are a few that stand out to me. I think two as the beginning of my, one is at the beginning of my legal career, and the other is an international case which was, you know, many years later, so maybe 20 years later. So I feel like they're sort of bookends of where I was in my career also. So the first case is United States versus Lanier, which is a 1996 case that ended up being decided by the U.S. Supreme Court. And it had to do with a criminal civil rights prosecution of a state court judge who had raped and sexually assaulted and threatened with adverse rulings if they didn't comply, women who were litigants in his court, women who worked in the court. It was pretty, it was quite an unfortunate set of facts. And because his brother was the district attorney, there was never any local prosecution or even investigation of that. But when the federal authorities came in to investigate something else, which was corruption by him and others, allegedly, they found all of these stories. They heard all of these stories from the women. And so they ended up prosecuting him for that behavior. And he was convicted. And then the conviction was overturned on the ground that it was not clearly established at the time he did these things that what he was doing was a violation of the constitutional right to bodily integrity. And so that's one of the requirements in our civil rights laws, that if you're going to do something, you know, it has to have been well established prior to your doing it, that it was some kind of constitutional violation to do that. And so surprisingly, that's what the Court of Appeals decided, was that it was unclear. And so the government asked the Supreme Court to take it up and to announce that basically it was clear and that his conviction should remain in place. And so I ended up filing an amicus brief in support of the cert petition and then filing a brief on the merits. And it was my very first appellate brief that I'd really had, you know, significant responsibility for. I was 29 years old, and I was very excited to have this opportunity. And it really was one of my first appellate cases. And it's what made me want to go into appellate law, because I saw the power of the practice. I mean, we were able in one case not only to, you know, rectify a decision that, you know, was not warranted. That's not where the law was pretty clear that that kind of behavior was a violation of bodily integrity. And also the impact that one case has. One case can have, it certainly impacted his case, but would it, you know, what impact would it have on other potential prosecutions? So it was an amazing experience. It's what turned me into being an appellate lawyer, and the result was amazing. And it was also an unusual circumstance because the government really, you know, doesn't talk. There was a lot of press interest in the case. And so the government wasn't talking about their side of the story. The judge and his friends were. They were on 60 Minutes and all these various shows commenting. So I was the only commentary on the other side of the case. So I learned really quickly the impact that the media can have in making people aware of these cases and what's going on in them and their, you know, potential impact from the decision. So it was a very important case in terms of where I decided to go with my practice and the power of appellate law. And then I'd say the second case is the cotton field cases against Mexico in the Inter-American Court of Human Rights. And that involved the decades-long disappearances and killings of young women and girls in Ciudad Juarez, which had gone unprosecuted and allowed to continue for so long as a result. And so the Inter-American Court, for the first time interpreting a women's rights treaty in the world, so first interpretation of that, and then also interpreting the human rights treaty, said, no, this Mexico is responsible for this because they gave rise to a culture of impunity allowed this to continue for so long. Their inaction meant that they were not respecting or ensuring women's rights. And they detailed in a very long opinion all of the systemic aspects in the justice system that undervalued or devalued crimes against women, how they were investigated, how whether they were prosecuted or not, and how they were treated in general. So that was just a remarkable result, an amazing decision that has had reverberations around the world, being the first women's rights treaty to be interpreted. It also had an immediate impact on a case that I was also involved in against the United States for enforcement of domestic violence laws or lack thereof within the United States, and the Inter-American Commission, not the court, pointed to the court's decision in the Mexico case in concluding that the U.S. had had an obligation also to respect and ensure that the laws that were on the books with regard to domestic violence were in fact applied, executed, and investigated. So that's an example of a lot of an impact of one case on subsequent cases and how the law can develop.
When you're doing a brief on one of these cases that you've been talking about, how has your process evolved when you are looking at these cases and deciding what to hone in on?
Yeah, I mean, in my case, I'm frequently writing amicus briefs for organizations or law professors who are interested in the case. They have some broader concerns or interest in the development of the law. In the case of Mexico, it was the first time that U.S.-based organizations and professors filed a brief at all in the Inter-American Court. So they have their own interests. But then I also look to see what else has been briefed already and where there might be a gap that should be covered, and whether we're the appropriate people to cover that gap and provide some expertise to the court in making its decisions. And also, I always think in these cases and others that judges are people too. And so you want to look at the case and say what fact or what aspect of the law seems to be the pivotal point here, or something that makes a difference in how I view the case. And so how do I bring that out in the brief? Because a judge might also have the same perspective, that's an important aspect. So, for example, in the Lanier case, the 1996 case in the U.S. Supreme Court, one of the things that I did was dig into as much data as I could, showing that other officials, whether they were immigration officers, police, maybe not judges, although there were a couple of judges too, how many previous prosecutions had been done involving sexual misconduct by these government actors, and had some of them just pled guilty, had some of them been convicted without any question being raised about whether this was some kind of novel constitutional right, and using those, because there weren't previous published cases, to say, hey, you know, this isn't the first prosecution that's happened in this setting. And we can look to that to say it's, you know, it's well accepted at some level. So that kind of thinking, a little outside of the box thinking about how we can make the case in this case and for future cases.
For the Nazi looted art cases that you've worked on, one of them that struck me was Zuckerman versus the Met. Can you describe your role in that and what you're bringing to the fore in your cert petition?
Yeah, so I've been really, it's been so amazing to be involved in the Holocaust art cases for quite some time. I started with the Altman case in a very small role, working with Randy Schoenberg when he was preparing for his U.S. Supreme Court argument. And the cases were so compelling, and Randy was doing so many of them after his big win in Altman, that that I ended up partnering with Randy on some other cases. And then, as happens, the more cases you do, the more people call you for other similar cases. And so I would say really the culmination of that was the cert petition in Zuckerman. And seeing, I just want to provide that background because it's not like I just came out of nowhere in the Holocaust art area when I was working on Zuckerman or Kassir or any of those cases. And so so I have a little bit of history in the arena there. One of the things that I think is frustrating in this space and challenging, and I think is obviously one of the things that Congress was trying to rectify with the HEAR Act, which was the subject of the Zuckerman cert petition, was all of these procedural hurdles, trying to get to the substance of the claims of heirs against museums largely, is very, very difficult and can take many, many years. And even after many years of litigation, there can be additional procedural questions, whether we're talking about statute of limitations, whether we're talking about jurisdiction, so many different aspects that come into play before you can even get to the core question of the case, which is, you know, who is entitled to this piece of art. And that can be really frustrating because it would be more satisfying to have some kind of ruling about that instead of at the procedural level. And as a result, I think there's some uncertainty in the law. And that's where I think the legislatures are trying to step in, whether they're state legislatures or Congress in that case, in the HEAR Act, saying, yeah, we're going to extend we're going to balance things. We're going to extend the statute of limitations on Holocaust recovery cases. We're going to do it for a certain period of time. So we're going to balance out the different interests. We're going to open up the door for these lawsuits, but it's only open for a certain number of years, and then it's going to close so that it gives certainty to potential defendants that if we're going to get anything, it's going to be in this 6-year period, and also have a sense of fairness for the claimants that they can investigate and bring these claims now, if they haven't already. So that was the balancing that Congress went through. And then the New York decision in Zuckerman was very concerning about this because the court concluded that a state law equitable doctrine could override the congressional statute and basically, you know, blow it out of the water in that case, in terms of whether the heirs could have brought the claims. And so that was the question in the cert petition was, you know, what does the HEAR Act mean? And how should an equitable doctrine from state law, you know, interplay with it?
It shows the need for careful drafting, especially with something like the HEAR Act, where the term at law was so pivotal, it seems. And if they could have just added and at equity, it would have changed the course, perhaps, of that case. What do you think?
Yeah, it might have. I think that sometimes it's hard to know, you know, how the sausage is made. And I think that especially in this setting where there is a lot of emotion on both sides. And also what I was so surprised to learn about when I started working on these cases was exactly how much art had changed hands during the Holocaust. And it was a remarkable amount, like 1/3 of the art holdings in Europe. And that is a lot of art. So if at this point, you're going to return all of that art, many of which is in museums, some of which is with private collectors, you are going to really have an upheaval in the collections of people who, you know, may have thought it was definitely theirs, you know, and there was no concern with the provenance, although that's not always true. There's sometimes some indicators that there might have been an issue early on. But that is a significant sea change in the ownership. And so despite, I think, people's theoretical interest in doing the right thing in returning things to the families who lost so much, it can be hard to do because you're talking about a significant move of art in the art world. And so I think that is coloring the decisions of those who hold the art at this point, and also potentially impacting the court's decisions. So getting back to your question about would it have mattered, would it have made a difference if the drafting had been clearer? I think I have two responses to that. One is, if it had been clearer, would the statute have been able to have been passed at all? Because maybe there would have been lobbying to not have that. The second question is, sometimes we think about the things that are in front of us, or the legislators think about things that are in front of us, but not that. You know, that wasn't something that was presented or that they may have thought they needed to say. The third point is, sometimes in these cases, people are, courts, judges are uncomfortable with a particular result. And so sometimes the reasoning helps them be more comfortable with a result. And so I think in Zuckerman, another aspect that wasn't part of the cert petition, but I think is an issue that's developing in Holocaust art recovery, which is the question of, you know, was it a forced sales, and how did those fit into the fabric of art recovery? And so this involved a forced sale. And so it may have been that the court was uncomfortable with the forced sale aspect and maybe kind of split the baby through the equitable application, saying, well, you know, we have this opportunity through our state law to determine that this particular case shouldn't be or can't be pursued, but we're not going to close the door on other cases that might come down the pike that don't involve a forced sale situation. I could see where that unspoken kind of thinking might be underlying the decision of the New York courts in that case. The problem is that so much art is held in New York, and when what the New York decision is, even though it's based on New York law, that, you know, that impacts a lot of art holdings.
In Zuckerman's cert petition, I believe you had referenced the Kasser case, which you mentioned a moment ago. And in that, it was pointed to that the Ninth Circuit had held early on, when the HEAR Act was first being applied, that the defense of latches, which is what Zuckerman was turning on, that it should not be applied. And so it's a conflict that many learned people have been grappling with.
Yeah, it's true. I think that, you know, it may be that the court would take up this question, the Supreme Court would take up this question at some point when there's a true and clear conflict between different decisions. But the time frame, you know, as we told the court, we're like, well, the time is now to take it, and don't wait for more conflict or more clear direct conflicts between holdings of different courts, because this time frame, this window of opportunity to file these lawsuits is quite short. So everyone would benefit from knowing the answer now rather than later.
Would you describe the work that you did before the Supreme Court in the Kasser case?
Oh, yeah. So Kasser has been, you know, sort of back and forth within the Ninth Circuit, back to the Supreme Court on various procedural counts on multiple occasions. I did some work in the Ninth Circuit briefing and also in its earlier iteration at the Supreme Court. Its most recent visit, I did not file a brief in that particular proceeding. But it was very notable to me, the questioning at argument in the most recent case where they did prevail was this frustration by the members of the court about how long the case had been pending already and how many trips it had made between various appellate courts. And just now we're dealing with, you know, yet another threshold procedural issue. How did that happen? And, you know, the sort of justice delayed is justice denied kind of theme that many of the justices mentioned. So I think that's a common, as I mentioned, a common thread of continued layer upon layer of procedural questions in these cases.
Did you also perhaps have any thoughts on the Gelf Treasure oral argument before the Supreme Court?
Oh, yeah. I hadn't had that top of mind, Stephanie, but I do think there's an interesting dynamic that the court has, and also I think that the U.S. government has, and the State Department, while there's certainly a lot of interest in doing the right thing, and there's a lot of statements by the U.S. government and others about returning art, the mechanics of that can be difficult, and how involved the government wants to be in making that happen, or even the U.S. courts themselves should be in making that happen, is, you know, really, it causes a lot of these cases to not be in the United States court system. I think the U.S. Supreme Court is interested in not opening up its courts to every case that doesn't have a, you know, clear and direct U.S. tie. There's concerns about immunity and about overreaching too much with our laws and our courts. And I think that stems also from the very original decision that the United States made with regard to Holocaust recovery, where when the Monuments Men gathered a lot of the pieces of art together, they then returned them to their respective countries and said, each of you decide where, what you want to do and how you want to return this to people. And there's a little hands-off aspect to that that I think continues through U.S. policy. So I think that has definitely colored where the court is going with regard to art that doesn't have this clear U.S. connection to our laws.
I do think, and I wonder what your thoughts are on the Ninth Circuit's addressing of this tension between the ethics and the justice in these cases in Casera, when it was discussing, I believe, that they can't force Spain to do the right thing, but they did call them out as preening as moralistic in their stance as pro-restitution in agreements like the Washington Principles and the Terezin Declaration.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's what I was talking about in terms of this, you know, aspirational view. And I think I do think that Washington Principles and a lot of those assertions that the art world itself made early on, I think that people want to do that. They want to do the right thing. They want to be, you know, the highest level of moral operation. But I think when it comes down to it and you see how much this is going to impact, how much of your collection it might impact, I think that's a different question. The theoretical concept is one thing. The application and implementation is something else. I think that people can find reasons why different cases should turn out differently or somehow claimants, you know, rested on their laurels and shouldn't have and should have moved faster. I mean, that was certainly the claim in Casera to some degree. But there has been, of the things that people have sought to recover from the Holocaust, there have been, you know, art was not the first thing people sought to recover, which I think is understandable from the standpoint of first, you're trying to survive. Second, you're trying to get your family together. Third, you're trying to rebuild your, you know, profession finances, you know, just family future. And then I think of the art as a sense of like the crowning glory of that in terms of dignity, restoring dignity to the family.
Absolutely. I'd heard you in a prior podcast discussing the upcoming oral argument in the Warhol Foundation case. I wonder if you have any thoughts on this side of the argument about what transpired.
Yeah, it was really interesting. I was wondering how the approach that the Warhol Foundation lawyers took. I'll say this case is litigated by great lawyers on both sides, Roman Martinez for the foundation and Lisa Blatt on the other side. So I think, you know, very, very well presented arguments, very well argued, both in the briefs and orally. But in order to prevail, the Warhol Foundation really has to win on its particular interpretation of what makes a transformative use and allows them to have these, you know, prints, art pieces without any need to license or anything like that, to have it be fair use. And that is really where the court attacked the foundation's position. I mean, they were concerned about original creators saying, well, how, okay, you know, how much whoever creates the original item that someone then works with, we're worried about where do their rights start and stop if we adopt your test, will we be cutting off a lot of rights to the original creators? And that seemed to be really echoing across the different justices' questions. And it became more of a question, in my view, to how are we going to write this opinion that says the Warhol Foundation loses, but how do we set the standard for future cases? That's kind of where it seemed to be going. And I was a little surprised by that, that it was that obvious where a lot of the justices seem to be going, but it's an interesting set of questions, and it really reveals a lot of the things that the higher courts are concerned with. They're concerned with the particular case in front of them, but they're also very concerned with the impact of the rule on other cases, and in this case on creators in other circumstances. I think one of the questions had to do with like Lord of the Rings, you know, Lord of the Rings movies and Tolkien's books, and would Tolkien, you know, get anything from the movies or not? And those kinds of questions are the kinds of questions you get in appellate courts. Yes, we know the case that's in front of us. Yes, we know the facts, but we're very concerned about how the rule that we're announcing is going to apply to a number of other cases.
The point that I believe Justice Gorsuch was going to about how to compare Warhol's soup cans, the purpose there was obvious, and Warhol wasn't trying to sell soup, whereas here, the images that are at issue makes it a bit muddier, highlighting the difficulty at issue in this case.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think also one of the, because there can be so many iterations of the artwork and the creative output that you're talking about when you're applying this law, that it's really hard. And I think that's also why there were so many you know, hypotheticals and pushing on different examples by the justices, because it is so creation and art specific about how you see something. Even the point you pointed out with regard to Justice Gorsuch's questions about even different kinds of Warhol's art, you know, could be viewed differently. One might be just fine and another might not be.
How do you see, depending on if the Supreme Court held for the foundation, and depending on how narrowly it's written, How do you see concerns for artists going forward?
Well, I think there's this balancing, which I think it was Justice Kagan was pointing out too, and I think also Justice Barrett, in terms of we have to balance the rights and the value that the original creators bring to something and not completely eviscerate their rights to things. But on the other hand, you want to allow innovation and iteration of things that are out there, because creativity comes in many different forms. One of them, which is not as celebrated as others, but nonetheless is very important, is combining different things together to create something new. And so it isn't like the whole thing is brand new, but you're having inspiration from different systems, different theories, different art styles. And so you want to allow that creativity and allow that to happen with, you know, as little hurdles as possible. But on the other hand, you don't want to trample over the rights of the original creator. So I think that's an important balance to make. And, you know, we'll see where the court makes it in the Warhol case. I think that it's an interesting case, because I think from a popular understanding of Warhol, you think, well, gosh, isn't that what he did, right? He took a lot of common objects, famous people, and made his own commentary in his art around that. And so it seems like we've seen all these pieces in museums, we've seen all of his art. And so there is something that he adds to the art universe from that work. But at this point, can we say it's still, you know, that's fine, but you've basically got to pay for it. You know, you have to license something. It's not fair use to do that, at least in some circumstances. I think that for some people, just from a, you know, layperson's perspective, you're kind of thinking, well, you know, Andy Warhol's a well-respected artist in his own right. How can we now be saying that essentially what he was doing was not all in his own right? But I think that gets back to the question or the distinction that Justice Gorsuch made. We'd have to look at this case by case and art piece by art piece. And I think that trying to craft a standard that has to apply to a number of different settings, that's going to be the rub, because what kind of impact it's going to have on artists and creativity evolving from one piece of art to another one is, there's going to be a certain level of uncertainty about that, and it might squelch some creativity and innovation to the extent you know that this is going to be an art piece by art piece kind of analysis, and you don't know whether your piece is going to come out on the good side of the analysis for fair use or not. You might not create certain things to begin with. So there might be some caution if the foundation does not prevail. And you could see in the number of amicus briefs on both sides of the case. I mean, there were so many, and from so many industries, from motion pictures to all kinds of creative organizations and artists and outlets who are, you know, expressing various concerns about different rules in the case.
Yes, and this does seem like it's ripe for going forward, creating many other cases of concern for artists, depending on their perspective.
Yeah.
I wonder if there is an issue that you see in our legal system in the States that especially concerns you about prohibiting access to justice?
There are certainly a lot of areas that people have expressed concern. We have a strong judicial system and a commitment to the rule of law, but the public needs to feel that there's fairness, and both in procedural fairness and substantive fairness in the system for that to continue. It's kind of a fragile balance. So situations like the Holocaust art recovery cases, where, as I said, over time, you keep seeing a lot of procedural questions, all manner of them being addressed, and the substantive issue of rightful ownership not being addressed, you know, that might create some concerns, saying, well, essentially it's stacked against the families because they don't have the same resources to keep fighting for years against the procedural hurdles. And then moreover, they may not get to an actual court ruling in their case. I mean, I think that's what really happened. That's what happened, actually. That was a choice in the Altman case. Having won the sovereign immunity question, the parties both decamped to arbitration in Austria, both sides saying, wow, this is going to be a lot faster. Whatever the result is, it's going to be faster. And we'll at least have a resolution much more efficiently than we would within the U.S. system. So having gained the right to litigate within the U.S. system, then they went off to Austria to arbitrate it. So I think that right there shows calculations on both sides. If you want a certainty of the result and you're not going to be able to reach any kind of settlement with regard to it, you're going to have a third party adjudicate it, that they just left the U.S. system to do that, because both sides recognized it was going to be a long slog. Yeah.
Going to your creation and hosting of the Portia Project podcast, would you describe how you have seen that mission, how it began, how it's evolved?
Sure. I mean, I think that's part of the creative process. Podcasting is a creative process too, right, mm-hmm. Stephanie?
Absolutely.
So, and I think that's one of the things that's neat about it. If you're publishing a book or you're working on a manuscript, it has one theme and you stick with that theme and that's the focus of the book. But podcasts can evolve because they are each their own episodic creation, but then your own curiosity can expand as a result of the conversations you have with the people who are guests. It's a very dynamic ecosystem. So the Portia Project podcast chronicles the journeys, the career journeys of women lawyers and judges thus far in the United States. And there's an array of women who went to law school from the late 1970s up through, I would say the 1990s at this point. And that was an important time of change in women's progress and entry into the profession. There were very few women in law schools in the 1970s. There were very few law firms who would hire women until the late 1980s. And the doors and opportunities really opened in the 1980s themselves. And through the stories of the guests on the podcast and their own personal experiences in their career, I think it more comes to life what that meant for women in different phases of, their becoming involved in the legal profession. And so I started out with the initial mission of, because I had started working on a book focused on women appellate judges in the United States, of which there were not as many as I thought there would be at this point, both in state and federal systems. There is no more than 150 women in appellate positions. And that seemed very low to me, given the number of seats on the benches we're talking about across the state and federal system. So I wanted to highlight those who were there, their stories of how they got there, because I have found that a lot of my friends, women friends who have become judges, they did not apply on their own. They were invited by others to apply. They were encouraged to apply. That often happens to that women look for too many boxes to check on the qualifications before they'll put themselves forward and may not have thought about that as an opportunity. So I thought, well, in case a particular judge does not nudge a particular person, maybe the podcast could be the nudge. I think one of the things that stops women from applying to the bench in some cases is that they think there's some mythical path that you have to follow. If you don't follow that career path, you'll never have an opportunity to become a judge. So for example, the traditional route was to be a DA or a federal prosecutor. And from there, you know, going to the bench. And I wanted to show the stories of women's paths that showed that even in the 1980s or 70s, there wasn't one path. There are many paths. And so don't count yourself out if you don't think you're in, you know, you have the perfect trajectory for a judicial position. So that was my initial goal. But then as I moved forward with it, I started to think more about women law students, people who haven't even gotten to law school yet, people who are new graduates. What would they want to know about career opportunities as well? The array of ways that you can use your law degree. And I thought, it's better to be in law school with a clear vision of what you want to accomplish. Even if you end up doing something differently, law school is very hard. And to stay in and persist, you have to have some larger vision for why you're there. And maybe people don't know the impact that the legal training can have in so many realms. And so I started talking to, and also the number of areas in which women are now leading. So I kind of wanted to profile both of those. So I just started thinking about all the different kinds of careers that are rarely discussed, you know, in the career services office, in the law schools. So from women managing partners of law firms to general counsel, to government positions, to legal nonprofits, and then to an array of areas which aren't even the practice of law. So a lot of newer, younger women attorneys are leaving the practice of law to become entrepreneurial, to start legal tech companies, to run other kinds of nonprofits like museums. And I wanted to highlight all of that as well. So it's become much broader. We have episode 65 since February of this year, just came out. And more than by next year, Supreme Court justices on at least 32 states will be represented on the podcast.
Well, I've already found so many of your guests and your dialogue with them so insightful for all the reasons that you just mentioned. And I'm very excited to hear from your future guests. It's such an array, as you've just said, and I greatly appreciate the work you're doing with that. It really does open doors and demystify paths forward for female attorneys.
Yeah. Oh, thank you so much for saying that, Stephanie. That's good. That's the hope. And also I think for the judges in particular, it's an opportunity for them to be human, to be people. I mean, I think a lot of the times we just see the robe, you know, behind the bench kind of thing, and don't really get the opportunity to understand their path, their personal path, some of the struggles that they've dealt with. I think with a lot of successful people, we think we just see the end, you know, we just see the end result. You don't see all of the challenges that come up. And I hope that that will encourage people as well to persist, because I think you can have they had a charmed life or whatever. You know, you just have this vision of it was a charmed, you know, one-way ascent to wherever they are. And it's often not the case at all, you know?
Yeah. And did I hear correctly somewhere that there might be a documentary being birthed out of the podcast?
Yes. So I'm working on One, I have, haven't decided how many, but I definitely have a couple in mind because we have, video as well as audio from the podcast. So one, a short documentary, so I'd say like 15 minutes or so, because I realized that not I'm the only one that has heard every one of these podcasts. So not everyone gets that. The things that seem clear to me thematically would not be clear to someone who's just dabbling and listening to different episodes that interest them. So I thought the documentary was a way to encapsulate some of the themes that have emerged from the different interviews and the different stories. And so one in particular that I'm planning to do is a documentary of exactly what I talked about in terms of women's experiences, depending on when they graduated, how their entry into the profession was treated, their experience in law school, and how their career progressed. I mean, another theme was that early on, as I mentioned, law firms were not, super excited to be hiring women lawyers. And so a lot of the best opportunities for training were in government work. So there were a lot of women judges, for example, who started in the prosecutor's office, in the county counsel's office, wherever they could in the government to get that experience. And over time, that changed, and you see more women across all areas of law practice. So encapsulating that story, I think that you can see data and read about it, but until you hear the stories, it doesn't touch you in the same way. It's not as personal or human. And so I thought it's a good way to encapsulate the different experiences that I've heard by people, by the guests.
Is there a projected date where we would start expecting to possibly see them?
Yeah, I'm planning to release them around at least the month of the 100th episode, which will be, I think, Women's History Month next year, so March 2023.
What a wonderful idea. And again, it's going back to that how creativity just creates and opens new doors.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's pretty neat. And also I think there's we talked about like the podcaster community, the community amongst the guests themselves that you create in the ecosystem of the podcast and the connections between those people. But also I think that some people see one thing, podcasting or internet related things, as just being online, but I see it as another tool to create community, raise awareness, and you can use one to reinforce the other. So an example of that is the Girls Inc. collaboration that we did very early on in the podcast. So I had the program chair for Girls Inc., which is focused on the growth of, I would say, junior high and high school girls to make them confident and strong young women so they can accomplish more in their lives. The program chair had legal training, and so she was a guest on the podcast. And we thought we had similar missions in our endeavors. And so we were finding a way to collaborate in that. And the way we found was for the Portia Project to do a live panel that would be recorded for the podcast, a career panel of women lawyers and judges in the community that would be in person in front of 100 high school girls who were going through an externship program and training this past summer. And so we had the direct connection, in-person connection with the high school girls. But then by recording it, we leveraged that experience and that wisdom out to really any high school girl who wanted to listen to it. At the same time, we're broadcasting the work of Girls Inc. and the positive things that they're doing. If people are unaware of them, they can learn about them. So I think about that as it's not just an online community. It's a sense of like how it's a tool. How can you use that tool to leverage the good work that an organization like Girls Inc. is already doing in the community? And also, how can you make the people who are contributing and donating their time feel much more impactful, right? There's one thing to reach 100 girls in a room. There's another thing to say, not only did I reach those 100 girls, but what I said can be heard by any girl, you know, anywhere in the world. So my impact from donating my time to do that is larger as well.
I recommend your podcast so highly, but especially that episode was one of the first ones I listened to. And it really is such a range of perspectives that are there to inspire the next generations.
Yeah, I've gotten a lot of comments from women lawyers who are quite experienced. And, you know, they were a little bit teary-eyed even. They said, we really enjoyed the Girls Inc. episode because we thought back to when we were in high school, we wish we had had something like that.
Talking about all of these wonderful women that you're highlighting who are such great role models, I wonder who was your role model growing up?
Yeah, I think there were a number of folks. I want to say first, my mother for sure. I mean, she's a strong lady. So, and she directly inspired me every day when I started to practice law by sending me these very nice, kind notes and quotations and things like that. So you can imagine when you're getting a pile of mail in the office, and it's, you know, deposition notices and motions and all of these legal documents. And on top is this handwritten letter with this, you know, positive quote or comment for the day. And it was, I really, in retrospect, really count that as something important in me, you know, staying in the law, especially early on. I think it's very hard as a young associate, especially as a young female associate, to carry on. So I definitely put that in that category. I think the other important set of folks were the judges that I worked for. I worked for three different judges, federal judges, who were amazing, very smart, a lot of integrity, really like a judge's judge, you know, all of them. Judge Dorothy Nelson, Judge Ferdinand Fernandez, both of them on the Ninth Circuit, and Judge Alice Marie Stotler, who was eventually the chief judge of the Central District of California. All of them were just amazing people. And I feel like law school taught me how to think like a lawyer, but the judges taught me how to be a lawyer. A lot of training from them and from seeing them in how they acted. Judge Nelson has in the past said things about me in terms of having like a certain, what she calls moral readiness, you know, in the law to make things right. And I feel like she can only say that because she has the same sense in herself.
I've heard you talk about how you took those mother's thoughts for the day and turned them into another form of creativity with your books. I wonder if you would share a bit about that, and also if there were one or two quotes that particularly resonated with you that you'd want to share.
Sure. So I think that starting a book publishing company and publishing books was not something I saw coming years previously. But I think that having done that has given me more, I don't want to say confidence, but a greater sense of a willingness to follow my intuition about something. So let me explain that. So like I said, I had come to realize a few years ago that what really kept me going early on were these notes from my mom. And I started thinking about, what if I didn't have them? What if I didn't have her to do them? And how many people might not have that same thing? And maybe I could pay it forward and increase her impact as well by putting them together into some really beautiful artistic gift books and putting them out into the world. And I honestly had this idea, and it was a struggle to get my mom to agree to do it. Speaking of, you know, copyrights and rights to things, right? I couldn't publish them without her approval. And she kept saying to me, oh, no, I didn't say anything important. No, I don't think so. I think it was just helpful to you. That's very nice that you thought they were helpful, but no. And so I started reading to her some of the things that she had sent me. And she was like, oh, that's pretty good. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. You could print that. That's fine. So it was fun because we worked on the book together. You know, she was approving which things would go in it. And it was just fun to kind of collaborate on the project a little bit. And I had no idea. The only thing I had in my mind was that I think this can do some good for someone. I don't know who it is, but I had a very strong feeling that it needed to be put out into the world. So it didn't bother me that I had no idea what I was doing. I mean, I didn't know how to do the graphic design. I didn't know even how to publish. I didn't know anything about publishing a book. And so I started doing research on who should I even talk to about how I move forward with this. And I started by researching on Amazon any books that looked like the kind of book that I wanted to produce, like was still in my head. And I saw this one book. I was like, oh, it's not the exact same thing, but it's the vibe that I want for this book. And I found out who had produced it, and I contacted them. And when I contacted them, the first thing that they said was, oh, we understand. Let us send you a book that we think is, you know, similar feeling to the one that you want to do that we did. And it was the book that I saw on Amazon. So I was like, aha, this is meant to be, this is the right group to do this. We're on the same wavelength. So I started with one book, then we had a sequel book. And then I got a lot of feedback from readers who said, we write lunch notes to our kids, you know, and we take them from the book and we put them in, you know, in their lunches. And we wish that we could make things as pretty as the book is, you know, because it's so nicely designed. So I was like, aha. So I listened to the customer and we created a self-guided journal that people can write, has prompts, and people can create their own book for their child or grandchild or whoever they want to do this with the same kind of themes that my mom used over time. So that's been really fun. And then we created all kinds of additional merchandise and pillows and t-shirts and posters and tote bags and mugs and all of this stuff with some of the, you know, very bright graphic sayings from the books on them. So that's been fun too. And that's actually every podcast guest gets some of the mother's thoughts for the day, you know, mugs or totes or things like that. So I'm kind of trying to continue to spread, you know, good cheer and positive thoughts. And every one of the books has won at least one, sometimes multiple independent publishing awards. And I hear very personal responses from people who it's impacted, whether it's impacted family relationships, whether it's allowed a child to open up to a parent about a very difficult circumstance in their life. It's had an impact on a significant and deep impact on at least a few people that I know about. And I feel like, well, if that is the only thing that these accomplished, that was definitely worth publishing them.
And what a lovely testament to your mother and her character.
Yeah, she's pretty great. So it's really neat. But I think that I don't think there would be a podcast if I hadn't done the book publishing, if that makes sense. Because I followed my gut on the podcast also, and I don't think I would have been as comfortable. The same thing, like I have no idea what it takes to do a podcast, but I didn't care because I'd already published books and I had no idea how to do that when I started. So no problem, you know, no problem.
That's totally the artist's journey, that you just keep going forward with what comes to you.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's the same. That kind of circles back to my first point about intuition, which is your gut about what to do. And it isn't specific. It's like this could do good. I have no idea what good that is. And I may never know what good that is, but I just have a feeling that it could make a difference for someone. And if I'm in a position to do that, I want to do it. And that's kind of the same feeling. I think the more you follow your intuition about things, the more you recognize it right away. Like that needs to be followed up because there's something there. It kind of keeps niggling at you and it won't go away. And I think in the podcast journey, that was a long time coming because it was really in finding the proper vehicle for what I wanted to do. And podcasting was absolutely the right one. And a book, you know, was not. I think that actually there could be a book from the podcast, but it would be an evolution of everything that happened through the podcast. I think that you're going to reach more people with the podcast, more of the people that you want to inspire, the younger people who aren't in the law. They'll listen to an episode, but they wouldn't pick up a book with 150 women judges in it. It just wouldn't be something that they would be drawn to in the same way. So I think sometimes being tenacious about continuing with something that you feel called to do, but finding the right outlet for it, that's part of the creative process too.
Yeah. And would you have any advice for mind management and/or time management?
Yeah, I don't know. I have an eclectic mind. I mean, that's just kind of what I do. And I think my form of creativity largely is making these connections between things that seemingly were previously disconnected, and that's just how my mind works. So it's almost like I can't not do it because there's always new ideas and new connections forming. And that's just the way my mind works. So it's almost like it's not a choice. So the question of time management and all of that is a good one, but it doesn't seem like it's an option for me not to do some of these other things. But I think that there's an integration between all of them. Just like I took a lot of creative writing classes midway through my career, because one of the original things that I thought I wanted to be was a poet before I became a lawyer. And so I had this early midlife crisis where I was wondering that, should I have been a poet and not a lawyer? Should I have been a creative writer, a full-time creative writer? And I took the classes and I discovered that I had in fact made the right choice and I should not be a full-time creative writer. But I learned so much about writing and storytelling from those classes and applied a lot of those principles to my legal writing that it made my legal writing better having done that. And that's how I feel about a lot of these other projects, is that you were all one person in a holistic view, and anything we do in one area will ultimately impact and hopefully improve and make more excellent the work that we do in another area and inform that work in a new way. So I feel like the payoff from it is that my advocacy gets more creative. My oral argument, I think it's better, because I think one of the things you learn from podcasting is that listening is super important and how to listen well. And that's an important thing to do in arguing to an appellate panel. I think there's a lot of benefits from doing all of this. And how do you manage the time? I mean, I think you just figure out how to do that for you. So for example, I'll say with podcasting, I record in batches, you know, like a few days a month, so that those are the days devoted to that. And then the rest of the time I'm, you know, working on cases and doing other leadership things. So that works for me. Some people like to just do, you know, an hour or two a day of that, or spending a certain number of hours a day. I tend to stay in the creative mode of whatever I'm doing for, you know, kind of in the zone, in the flow for a certain period of time. That's the same thing with writing a brief too.
In closing, I wonder if there is a particular definition of justice that has come to you over the course of your career, or has it evolved?
Yeah, I thought this was such a good question. I'm like, you know, before you asked this question, I hadn't really thought about like, what does justice look like to me, or what do I think it should look like? So I just am going to say like what came to my mind when I read your, you know, when I heard the question, and a sense of fairness and moral rightness. I mean, I think that's part of what we hope for. I think also just treatment, both in the substance and in the procedure, including, I think, a genuine respect for the individual. I think that sometimes the system has a method and a process, and it may not take into account the individual as a unique being, instead of like, oh, you're in this role and here's how we treat that person in this role in this particular case. And I think that's very important to make sure that there's dignity for the individuals who are involved in the justice system. I also think the question of justice depends on confidence in the justice system and the rule of law of the public in general, and both the substance of the decisions, the reasoning of the decisions, the appearance of fairness, the sense of fairness and procedural fairness in a particular case is important as well. A lot of trial judges will say that even when litigants lose in a case that they have presided over, if they have felt heard, if they have felt that all of the arguments were taken into account, that they were treated with respect, that they still, you know, that they still walk away having a sense of the rule of law, even if it did not come out the way they wanted it to. And that's, I think that's the building block of how you maintain the integrity of the judicial system, you know, on a day-to-day basis. That may be the only time that someone has experience in a court.
Of all the work that you do that we've been discussing, and there's so much more, I wonder what legacy you hope to be creating.
Yeah, I've never thought about that in terms of that legacy, that term, but I think about the power of one person standing up for what's right, even where it's not easy to do so, and it can be challenging, and it might seem like a hopeless battle. It's important to do that. That's how rights are reinforced, how rights are created. That power of the individual and the importance of the individual as well as, you know, rights and responsibilities to society in general. But the fact that one person can make a difference, I think that is probably the most like fundamental theme of everything that I've done. And I hope that it encourages other people to stand up for what they think is right as well.
Oh, is there anything that you want to share that I have not asked you, MC?
Well, I think you asked me, which I don't think I answered actually, which was like some of the favorite, you know, notes or comments that my mom sent to me. There's three that stand out to me, and I'll explain why. So she always says like every day, which is like, make this the best day ever at the start of every day. And then related to that is every day is a new canvas. Paint it the way you want to with your brush, not someone else's. And then the third one is, do not let a challenge become an excuse for not doing something. And I think those three really sum up what is important to think about in making your own mark in the world and to persisting when things are difficult. So start each day brand new. You know, even if yesterday was terrible, start it anew. Each day is a new opportunity for something different. Execute on your vision and don't be a victim. You know, the kind of this sense of like self-actualization and resilience and persistence. And I think all of those are so important for women in particular in their careers. There are a lot of challenges. And I think about the commonalities. I hadn't really thought about the connection between the mission of the podcast and the book publishing, because they seem very disparate. But I think that the common theme is that each of them is designed to inspire and empower and highlight women and give them tools that they need to become, you know, most fully themselves and to contribute in the most meaningful way. Each person comes to this life with particular skills and particular things that only they are able to do. And if through the podcast and the books that we're helping people become that and to do the thing that only they could do in the world, then, you know, we've done a good thing.
There will be links in the show notes to learn more about Ms. Sangaila and her work. If you enjoyed this podcast, you can subscribe on your preferred platform. And if you'd like to support more episodes like this, it would be much appreciated if you could leave a rating or review. You can also leave your comments online and tag Warfare of Art and Law podcast or email me at stephanie@warfareofartandlaw.com. And the podcast Patreon page has rewards for those interested at patreon.com/warfareofartandlaw. Until next time, this is Stephanie Draughty bringing you Warfare of Art and Law. Thank you so much for listening. And remember, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. What are your plans for the second Saturday of this month? Perhaps consider joining in for a discussion about art, culture, and social issues. Hi everyone, it's Stephanie, and every second Saturday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, I host the Second Saturday Art and Justice Gathering, an online call that explores a range of topics, from artists who might inspire to legal decisions that might infuriate, all with the aim of sparking dialogue about social justice and promoting creative thinking. If interested, please email me at stephanie@warfareofartandlaw.com.